Welcome to Resurrection Recovery, a ministry of hope and healing provided by Church of the Resurrection. This podcast is produced by Resurrection Recovery participants as a way to share their experience, strength, and hope as they move through the recovery journey. You can join us every Thursday night at 6 p.m. for a community meal and a personal story, and then support groups at 7 p.m. Check our website at core.org/recovery for special events, location, and a group that might fit your need.
All right, welcome everybody. Did anybody hear that? Okay, just wanted to make sure. Turn the mic up a little bit. My name is Tom Langhofer, and I serve as our pastor of recovery ministries here, and I'm recovering alcoholic, and I'm glad you're all here. We meet every Thursday night. This is called Resurrection Recovery, and it was started back in November to bring people from the recovery community together, those of us that have battled addictions or family members that have had to put up with us that are battling addictions. And I don't know what's worse, but the idea is to bring everybody together to share that common bond of walking in the shoes of addiction. And it's not something any of us would ever wish on anybody. But for me personally, I've met some of my best friends through the programs of recovery. And so our intent is to bring everybody together, to share the fellowship of this, have a little pizza, and then hear a personal testimony from somebody in the recovery community that is either in recovery or has been affected by it, to share their experience, strength, and hope, because there is hope for all of us, right? You may not think it sometimes when we're out there, or you're the family member and you just don't know what to do, but there's people in these rooms and in the support groups that can help you through it. So we're glad you're here. So our routine is pizza, fellowship, testimony, and then at 7 o'clock we break into small groups. We have on the table little handouts. We have 14 different support groups that meet after the testimony. Right upstairs, the AA group meets over in Building C, and then the young adult group meets over in Building C, too. And then we wrap up at 8 o'clock, and that's our routine every Thursday. All our meals are funded by the recovery community. It's not funded by our church, and I don't mean that as a knock on our church, but we're trying to show the church and the community that the recovery community can be self-sustaining. All the people that are out greeting you, that are serving, have all been affected by addiction one way or another, and all the meals are provided by organizations or people that are involved in recovery. So this week's meal, the pizza, was provided by Midwest Recovery, and I don't know if any of Midwest Recovery folks are here tonight, but they're usually here. So thank Midwest Recovery for the meal. I'm going to introduce Susan Whitmore in just a second, but next week, speaker is a young man named Hayden Hanna, and he runs the young adult group here. He's 20 years old, never shared his testimony. He just celebrated 4 years sobriety, and so next Thursday, come and support this young man, because he's really nervous, but he's got a great story, and so Hayden will be sharing next week, and then 2 weeks from now, we have a guy named Toby Cook from the Kansas City Royals. He's the vice president of marketing for the Kansas City Royals and was a former newscaster here and locally, so he'll be here in a couple weeks. So we're always going to have somebody that I think will be an interesting speaker for you. And I forgot what I want to always try to do, and it's a little late, but I'm still going to do it. My tradition of the AA group that I go to is we open with a moment of silence, followed by the short version of the Serenity Prayer. So if we can start off with that, and then I'll welcome Susan up here. Thank you. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So I want to welcome Susan Whitmore up here. Susan is the CEO and president of First Call. And if you aren't familiar with First Call, I hope that she'll explain it a little bit to you in just a minute, along with her personal testimony. We work quite a bit with First Call. Susan's also on our recovery committee. We meet every month here to help plan out things for our recovery community. And just very, very involved in recovery in the Kansas City area. So I'll let her do the talking from here. So let's all welcome Susan Whitmore with First Call.
All right. Hi, everybody. My name's Susan Whitmore, and I am an alcoholic. I am also in long-term recovery for 12 years, and thank you, as of November 7th, and so working on my 13th year here. I am one of those people who probably shouldn't be alive. And what I mean by that is my disease really took me to a place where I almost didn't make it through. And I remember when I was struggling to get into recovery that people used to say to me, you know, if you ever get sober, you're going to have a really good story to tell. And I would be like, oh, piss off. Like, I just was like, that is not, like, encouraging. anyway, before I get to that, as Tom mentioned, I am the CEO at First Call, and I've been with First Call for 10 years. It used to be called the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, and we do alcohol and drug prevention and recovery services for the region. And but I think, as all of you know, it really takes a village to deal with this issue. And all the forms that it takes for people. And one of the biggest problems we see is that people tend to overdose and die after treatment. So even if people get to treatment, we know the gaps are in the places where people are not in a support group or not, you know, where they have to find their own way. And I truly believe that every individual who's working on a recovery program deserves and needs, someone walking right along with them. And some of us find that in 12-step groups and, you know, through our sponsors, mentors, whatever that might be. Some of us might have a minister or a faith-based teacher who is that helper for us. But basically, you know, the whole system needs to be sort of retooled, I think, to have that one-on-one piece for every individual, not just while they're in services, in an institution, or in residential treatment or outpatient treatment, but after that and going forward. And because of the work I do at First Call, I know just enough to be dangerous from a clinical perspective. And, you know, we know that it takes at least 2 to 5 years for people to get into a sustained recovery. And so part of what we try to do at First Call is provide the support where we stick with people through that time period for as long as the person wants to stay, and our recovery advocates work with people one-on-one. And it's free, the services are free. So, but also we do family services for loved ones who are impacted by someone's addiction. And that those are classes for kids who, you know, have a parent with a substance use disorder, and also adults who have either a child or a spouse or another family member who is struggling. And those are clinical programs, because a lot of what we see is that people who are affected by someone's addiction are even worse off than the person who's struggling to get into recovery. Many of the parents, I'll just give you one example. Like, if you think of being a parent and you have a child who is a heroin addict, and you've had the experience of waiting up and not knowing if they're going to come home at night, you've had the experience of the police coming to your door and you don't know if they're going to tell you that your child has died. Maybe you've been called to the hospital because your child has had an overdose. You don't know if you can talk to your neighbors or family about what's going on, and so you become more isolated. People get PTSD from these experiences, you know, and they need just as much support as the people who are going through a recovery program, because they become isolated, depressed, not always, you know, but in many cases, isolated, depressed, trouble eating, trouble sleeping, all the same symptoms that people who have a substance use disorder have, only they don't have a tool, that thing that, you know, that they're using to make it work. So, anyway, that's my cue to stop talking about stuff like that. Anyway, I firmly believe personally as well as professionally that, like, those family services are just as important as what we're doing for people who need recovery. And I say this partly because it goes along with my story. I didn't develop alcoholism until I was in my 30s. And what I mean by that is I was a social drinker before that. I had some things going on in my mid-30s. I have two kids and was going through a hard patch. But I had a good career. I was doing well. You know, I had friends, community. I have a great family. I was not married. I was divorced. You know, I went through this hard time, and I started drinking more regularly, and eventually it got its hooks in me. I ended up, and I know through what I've been through in treatment to know that this is a more common story for women than men. A lot of times men will have a slow development of alcoholism, and women sometimes develop, if they develop it in middle age, it tends to be a very steep climb, very fast. The disease progresses very quickly. And a lot of women end up dead, and that's absolutely my story. And it's also really confusing because I thought I was fine. There was just something a little wrong in my life, and I needed to fix it, and then I was going to go back to being fine. But after you develop alcoholism, it just, the brain disorder does not, it's not like all of a sudden you can become a normal drinker. So, like many people in that situation, I started to know that I had a problem. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew enough to know that that's where you go if you think you might have a problem. But I was still really not that sick. And so I was looking at the differences with other people. Other people had more serious things going on. I still had my job. I was showing up. Basically, it's a progressive disease, and so it got worse and worse. But I went in, I did, you know, I worked the steps, I got a sponsor, but then I decided I wasn't an alcoholic, went back out, and that began like 4 years of a really crazy spiral that got worse with every time I relapsed, where I would be out for 2 weeks, in the program for 3 weeks, out for 4 months, in for 2 weeks, out for 6 months, in for 2 days, you know, just ping-ponging back and forth. And every time I would go back to drinking, it was worse for me. And eventually I started hiding alcohol, and that was a really big turning point because my tolerance level went way up. It was part of the progression of the disease. It used to be I could only have like 2 to 3 glasses of wine, then it was half a bottle, then it was a bottle. Eventually, when I started hiding alcohol, it became vodka. And enough people knew that I had been in the program, so I was trying to hide it if I was drinking. And that's when I became a liar, you know. And I had never been someone who was a liar before. I mean, we all tell white lies now and then. But, like, it wasn't, like, an issue for me that I was disingenuous or faking something. But I started at that moment, and that is part of the disease. And that's when things got really, really bad. As I mentioned, I have two kids. My daughter was, you know, it was between the ages that she was 7 and 11 while all this was going on. And my son was, like, between the ages of 11 and 17. And not a good time when you're a single mom to be having those issues with kids that age. They really need their parents. And so that was a mess. And I can honestly say, as a woman who was struggling in this way, that was the hardest part of my disease for me, was to know that I was a mom who loved her kids more than anything else in the whole world, and I couldn't I couldn't get well for them. And I, you know, eventually ended up going to treatment. After 4 years, I went to treatment. The last 3 years of this, I had 7 years of in and out of recovery. I can't even say I was in recovery. I was in and out of trying to be abstinence, you know. And the last 3 years got really hairy. You know, like a lot of alcoholics, I saw a psychologist for anxiety. I was put on an antidepressant and anti-anxiety medicine. But I'm not clinically depressed. I'm not a clinically depressed person. It's alcoholism creates clinical depression because of the way things go up and down. You obviously have anxiety whenever you're doing that mini detox every day after drinking. And so I started to have anxiety attacks. But now I'm drinking and I'm on medication. And that, you know, it's a very common story. And it is just a mess. And it's so dangerous. And, you know, it's one reason why I'm glad there's a little more awareness that's happening now for doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists to know that, like, you can't treat it that way. I ended up in those last 3 years going to four different 30-day treatment programs. I went to Valley Hope once after 2 weeks of being out of that, and I swear to you, while I was in treatment, I was the best treatment person. Like, I was doing the deal. I really thought I was gonna get it. I felt like I was, like, in line with everything, and I wanted it. And 2 weeks after treatment, I was drinking again. And then, you know, 6 months later, I end up back in treatment. At this point, in those last 3 years, if I would start drinking again, within 48 hours, I would end up in the hospital. So I had a total of six trips to the hospital for detox because I was, you know, like the last time I went to detox, I had like a 0.4 alcohol, you know, where, and they're like, I don't know how you're like alive. But something really weird in my physiology was just, you know, where if I picked up a drink in that last part, this only took 7 years for this to happen, but in those last 3 years, if I picked up a drink, I could not stop drinking, and I would have to be drinking around the clock. And so within 2 days at the end, I would be in the hospital. And I'm lucky I had people around me that took me to the hospital, because a lot of people don't, and they don't make it. So I went, you know, I went to Valley Hope. 2 weeks after treatment, relapse. 6 months later, go back to Valley Hope. What happened? You know, you try to make it different this time. You know, I really tried again. Second time, same thing. I think I made it a month after that treatment. Next time I went to Hazleton, I went to another state. You know, another 30-day program. And like 3 weeks after treatment, I was drinking again. The last time I went to a 30-day treatment was Valley Hope again. And during all this, these 7 years, I had gotten married. Don't ask, okay? Like, I was in my disease. I will just say that. But it was, you know, not a good situation. But my last treatment, while I was in treatment, I got served divorce papers. And all of my possessions got moved into a storage facility. I mean, you can put together the pieces of what was going on at home, you know. And my children, I was separated from my children at this point. They were living with their dad. Not legally, but I did not have access to my children. And my children did not want to have access to me. And so I was really at a very low place in my life, and I had lost hope completely. I thought I was one of those people that would never be able to get this deal, that I was constitutionally incapable, because I knew in my heart I had tried with all my might to do it, and it wasn't working. And I was also someone who went to meetings all the time, and I had a sponsor, and I worked the steps. But I always had a secret, and I always had something I wasn't telling. And there was a part of me that had a really strong attachment to feeling like, if I give all of myself over to somebody else, I'm going to die. you know, and I just didn't know what was going to happen if I gave up all my secrets. Like at the end, my, and so whenever I did a fifth step, for example, for those of you who know the inventory and telling, you know, of your, of things that you do and basically being honest, you know, I would never tell the whole story. There would always be something I'd hold back, and if I had a secret in my pocket, that was something that made me feel like I had some kind of power. And literally, my life was falling apart and imploding. And but I went to this 30-day treatment. I knew my marriage was falling apart. I'd been to that detox right before treatment, you know, the same routine. And in treatment, I got told that all my stuff was in storage, and all my kids' stuff was in storage, and I was out of the house, and I had been served divorce papers. So now I'm homeless and have nowhere to go after treatment, and I'm not talking with my kids. They're not talking with me. And I was that woman who relapsed because she relapsed because she relapsed because she relapsed. I had so much shame around being a mom who was an alcoholic after having been a good mom, good, because that's a relative term. You know, it just was baffling. And I know today it's not a moral issue, it's a health issue, but at the time I did not know that. I thought I was broken in some way and that there was something wrong with me. What happened after that treatment is I got an apartment and I went to move all my stuff out of storage. The day I left treatment, went to move all my stuff out of storage into this apartment and had called the movers to come. They brought all the stuff, they dumped it in this apartment. And basically, I didn't make it from, while the movers were loading up my stuff, I went and got a prescription filled for Xanax and I got a bottle of vodka. And I just couldn't handle it. And I went, you know, I was gonna unpack and start my new life, you know, with the help of Xanax and alcohol, of course. And, but, you know, basically I almost died. And I don't remember anything of what happened during this time, but except for what people tell me. And a friend of mine came over to the apartment to help me, and she couldn't wake me up. She could not revive me, so she called 911. She came over on a fluke. The only reason I'm alive today is because she came to the apartment and because I hadn't locked the door. And she was able to get in, or else I would not be standing here today. And, you know, the EMT was this guy who was the husband of a woman who I had been in treatment with, and he recognized me when he came to the house, you know, and carried me out of this apartment. And it's wild because later he came back and said, I'm the one who carried you out of that apartment, you know. But anyway, I went to the hospital, and the social worker at the hospital was on the phone with my parents who live on the East Coast, telling them, we don't know if Susan's going to make it. And my dad had to call my siblings and say, we don't know if Susan's going to make it. And that's the impact this has on, you know, and this has been going on for years with them, of course. But, and the next thing I remember, I wake up in an ambulance being transported back to Valley Hope with that awful feeling, if you've ever had your stomach pumped, that taste. And, but also I had no idea what was going on. By the grace of God, when I got to Valley Hope, they told me, we can't help you anymore. This is your third, I mean, you just left, right? We've done everything we can do for you. You need long-term treatment. And this was not the first time this had been suggested to me, but they told me, if you didn't go to long-term treatement, you were probably going to die. And I am one of those people, and this is not true for everybody, because some people can go to 12-step programs and groups and get it and get into a sustained recovery. But what I know today is if you have late-stage alcoholism, it takes at least 6 weeks for your brain chemistry to heal enough, like to be in a safe place and abstinent for 6 weeks for your brain chemistry to return to enough normal that you can make a beginning. And 30-day programs, 28-day programs don't cut it. they didn't for me. People who are, you know, not as sick, it can be okay. It's not the same for everyone. I mean, that's the weird thing about this is like it's that's what makes it so hard. Everybody is different. But you know, someone who was in the program came and talked to me about a few different programs that were longer term, like 3 months. And I ended up going to a 90-day program in Louisiana. And I spent my last money that I had from my retirement fund and my savings and everything. I spent my last money on that treatment. And I had never wanted to go to a long-term treatement because I didn't want to leave my children. And I also remember saying to a therapist at one point, you know, I think my kids would be better off without me. And she said, you know, I work with a lot of families and a lot of kids, and a dead mother is much worse than an alcoholic mother for a kid. And, you know, it's really hard, but sometimes you have to make the choice to go in order to be able to be there. And I have an amazing relationship with my kids today. Like, they are... I'll just tell one more thing of what happened, because like that was my turning point, was going to that treatment center. And I'm also aware that there are a lot of people who can't do that because they can't get to that treatment center and they don't have someone to take them, or they don't have someone to pay for it. And all that is wrong, you know? I mean, it should be accessible for everybody. But I needed to be separated from everything. I needed to be in a safe place. I needed to stop coming out of treatment and trying to put my life back together in a week, like to be the good mom, the good worker, the good everything all at once. It took me 2 years after getting out of treatment to really put all the pieces back together, and I took my time for the first time, and it worked. But the change for me was I had what they call that psychic change, which is really a spiritual change. When I got to this treatment center, the first day I was sitting out and looking out over this cow pasture, and just thinking, I have no husband. I don't have my children with me. I don't know if I'm ever going to have my children again. I don't know if I'm ever going to have my family again. I had pretty much burned bridges with all my friends. I hadn't worked in 6 months. I had no money. I was homeless. I had nowhere to go after I got out of treatment. I had no idea what that looked like going forward. And everyone kept saying to me, why did you try to kill yourself? Because when that ambulance came to get me, the bottle of pills was empty. And like the alcohol was gone. And I don't remember trying to kill myself. I love being alive. I love being on the planet. And I know there's so many people who die and we say they killed themselves, you know? But when we're under the influence, like, man, I didn't want to kill myself. But that's what was happening. And it took me months to convince my counselor in treatment that I actually wasn't suicidal, because I was desperate to stay alive. I love being alive. I love being on the planet. And in that moment where I was thinking about that, about like, I'm alive and I shouldn't be alive, you know, and I was so glad, and I thought, I have all these things, I'm listing all the things I don't have, and I was like, but I'm here, I'm alive. And it was like the biggest gift I had ever received in my whole life. And the next thing that hit me was that I was loved unconditionally. And that I was deserving of a good life, not because I was a mom, not because I was a wife, not because it was what I was supposed to be because I'm a woman of, you know, an educated person or whatever that is from the family I'm from, but because I it was enough in and of itself for me to have that just for me, to be alive and have a good life. And that I was loved unconditionally, and that I had come into the world with that love. And nothing I had done up until this point could taint that or change that. And it didn't even matter if I stayed sober. I could not wreck that love, that I would be loved always. And not only that, then everyone has that. Like, everyone's loved like that. And I was like, whoa, you know, I mean, my head was exploding. But the thing, that was my beginning. Just to know that I was loved and that it wasn't like that I had to do good in order to get the love. It just was. And it took the pressure off having to be perfect at the treatment program or perfect in any way, you know. But it was enough, and it changed everything for me. And I stopped trying to get sober for my children, and I stopped trying to get sober for anyone else in my family because they were gone. And I did it for me. And it was the most beautiful experience I've ever had in my life. And I carry that with me all the time. I mean, I don't walk around all the time being like, oh, I'm so loved, you know. But I can remind myself, and it's there. And I know it's there. And I tell it to people all the time who are... I work with a lot of women who are moms, too, you know, and I'm like, this is the deal. It's serious, this love. It's really true. And you know, and I went through that treatment, and just like they say, and then after that treatment, I lived in a recovery house with women for 2 more months after I got back to Kansas City and, you know, got a job and started putting my life back together. Eventually got a little apartment. My daughter came, and my son was out of the house at this point, but my daughter came and lived with me in an apartment, and then eventually we were able to get a little house, and, you know, everything has grown from there, and that literally 12 years ago, that was my beginning. But I have to say, when you lose everything, after that, everything you get, every little thing is a gift. And the first day, it was just being alive. And not, I don't mean just being alive. It was like the biggest gift ever. But like the day, waking up in the day was like a gift. And then when I finally had a place to stay that was safe, that was a gift. And then when I finally had a sponsor, that was a gift. And then when I finally had a job, that was a gift. And every little piece, and it seemed like my higher power really helped me not get too much all at once, I will say. You know, it was like it just came in the right amount so that I just stayed right size all along. I didn't date for 2 years. I was like totally flatlined, you know, like not interested, flatlined. I think that was my higher power protecting me too so I could stay focused, you know. And I love my life today. And my kids, we never swept it under the rug. They got counseling too. I know everyone's big on that here too. And that was really important for them. My son's in recovery. He had to finish high school at a recovery high school because he got off track around the same time I did, and or got on the track that we seemed to get on. But anyway, I know it's time to stop for the groups, but. Thank you so much for listening to my story. And if there's anyone out there who's struggling, just keep the faith and know you're loved. And it really does come. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you would like more information about this ministry or Church of the Resurrection, visit our website at core.org/recovery, where you can find a listing of support groups that meet every Thursday. If you would like more immediate attention, our congregational care ministries have several support options such as prayer requests, counseling, etc. at core.org/care. Thank you for listening today.